Okay, so in 2007, I was diagnosed with cancer, and after chemotherapy and 5 years of going to see my doctor on a regular basis, after 5 years, one day my oncologist says to me, "All right, you're cured. You're, you know, you can go on. You've graduated." But there's one thing, you know, I've been waiting to ask you about, and I wanted to wait until you were cured. And I'm thinking, what does this doctor want to say to me? He says, "You know, I have an idea for a TV show."
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, it was like only in LA, right? Only in LA was your doctor pitch you a TV show.
Oh, my God.
So he says to me, "There's a lot of funny things that happen in this office. No one would ever think cancer is funny, but, you know, here's some funny stories." So I thought about it. I thought, hey, this is a pretty good idea. And I hired some writers. We wrote a script and we gave it to WME, who was representing us. They loved it. And they told us that in order to help sell it, we needed to attach ourselves to a big time comedy producer. And the reason I'm telling the story today is because the guy we attached was none other than Paul Feig, our guest on the show today. And Paul loved the script. He really flipped out for it. He gave us one note, which we changed. And then we went out to all the different networks around town, you know, HBO, Showtime, Netflix, TBS, TNT, Comedy Central. And guess what?
Oh, what?
Everybody passed.
Oh, no. Oh, come on.
Yeah. Everybody passed on the show, but we got word from our agents that Vimeo, of all places, was launching a streaming service to compete with Netflix, and they were interested in our show. And we're all like, "Wow, this is amazing." And we go in there and pitch it, and they buy it in the room. So they say they're going to send us an offer letter, they're going to send us a deal, be on the lookout in the next couple of days. And we're all so excited and so happy. And then literally 3 weeks later to the day, they went out of business.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So there you go. I guess this project has just been cursed.
Oh, my God.
So I was really bummed out about it. I was feeling like a complete failure. And around that time, I had lunch with a friend of mine who's also a producer. And he says, "Dude, there's no reason for you to be upset. You got a script written. Paul Feig loved it. He attached himself as an executive producer and director, and someone bought it. Of course, that place went out of business, but they bought it. That is a hard thing to do, what you did." That really changed my way of thinking about it. Sometimes things take a while to sell. I mean, The Queen's Gambit took 30 years or something. So right now, it's just sitting in a drawer, and hopefully it'll sell one day. So I guess it's a way of just never giving up and never surrendering. I'm Jack Hergith.
And I'm Stephen Kramer Glickman.
And this is Never Surrender,
the show where we sit down with the most successful people in the entertainment industry to talk about failure and how they pushed through it and never gave up.
Because we've all failed. We've all had setbacks.
Yeah, we've all questioned whether to keep going.
But at some point, everybody struggles.
Yeah. I mean, I've been let go from some of my favorite jobs.
You and me both. We just hope that by listening to this podcast, it will help give you the strength to never surrender.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Well, then, let's welcome our next guest, because he really is one hell of a guy.
He's a writer, a director, whose movies have grossed $1 billion. Can you believe that? $1 billion worldwide at the box office. He's the director of huge comedy films like Bridesmaids, Spy, The Heat, and the 2016 Ghostbusters reboot.
And he's also the creator, writer, and executive producer of television shows like Freaks and Geeks, and has directed award-winning shows like Arrested Development, The Office, Mad Men, and many more.
You'd think a guy like this has never failed at anything. But surprisingly, he's had his share of disappointments. But you know what? He's never given up. He's never surrendered. This is Paul Feig.
Mr. Paul Feig.
Well, hello. Hello, fellas.
Wow. Hello, Paul.
So cool, how's it going? And everyone else here. They got an amazing group. A great fresh-faced team. I love it.
Well, thanks for joining us. We're very honored and humbled to have you here with us today.
I know, Paul, that you started in stand-up. That was like kind of how your career started. And you were very young when you started.
Yeah, I fell in love with stand-up, I mean, when I was a kid, and, you know, loved George Carlin, but I really fell in love with Steve Martin, and that was like when I was like 13, I think, when he first kind of came on the scene and started hosting SNL, and even before the album came out, and then when the first album came out, Let's Get Small, that was like a big deal in the comedy world, and I was just a comedy aficionado back then, but nobody in my school knew that he existed, and so I remember the album would then go to school and do the routines and pass them off as my own.
Oh,
and
God.
And everybody thought I was a genius. And then Steve Martin became very famous and popular, and then they realized I was just a thief.
Like, hey, Paul, there's this guy ripping off your material.
Yeah,
he's
like,
on
what?
TV.
Let me
what
get my dad's lawyer on this. but then there was also a show on TV at the time called Make Me Laugh, which was hosted by Bobby Van. And
love that show.
Yeah, it was great. And, if your audience doesn't know what it was a game show in the very loose context or pretext that basically there'd be a contestant would come out and they'd sit in this chair, and then three comics on the show would come out and try to make them laugh. And they had like a minute to make them laugh. But it was all just an excuse to do stand-up comedy. And there was a guy on the show named Mike Binder, the famous Mike Binder, who went into, ended up being a great film director too. But he was a great stand-up comedian. And they would always go like, Michigan's own, Detroit's own. And I'm from Detroit. So I was like, wait a minute. Like, he's famous and he's on TV doing stand-up and he's from Detroit, where I'm from. So that was the moment I was like, well, maybe I can do this. And so found out that there was a comedy club in our area called the Delta Lady, which was a biker bar. It was a biker bar in like a really bad part of Detroit.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And, but I signed up for the open mic night. I called them up and got on the list. They said, I'm 15 years old. They're like, well, you have to bring your parents to get in.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I dragged my parents down to this really crazy biker bar. But then there's a lot of future stars there. Dave Coulier was performing.
Oh,
that
wow.
night.
Really?
He'd kind of become one of the regular guys there. Yeah. And he was, I remember he was really nice to me because, took me very kind to the 15-year-old kid. And he's like, here's what you want to do and stuff. And, kind of gave me some advice.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I got up and did it. And it was, it was not good, but but I got laughs.
How did you feel like the first time you went up? Did you feel like it went well the first time, and then later than trying to do it again and again?
Well, it was just that, I mean, I was terrified to do it, but I was also excited to do it.
Sure.
And I remember that morning, like laying in bed going like, oh my God, I'm under the covers and nobody can see me, but tonight I'll be on a stage and everyone will be looking at me. And it was just this like a mind blowing idea. But then when I got up there and did my act, which was really dumb, it was all, when you're 15 years old, God only knows the jokes.
What was your act like?
I was a big Johnny Carson fan at the time. So like some of my punchlines were about New Jersey, and I was from Michigan. I didn't know New Jersey from anything. And I could have easily made it a Detroit reference by saying Zug Island, which was like the big punchline in Detroit. But of course, that I went to New Jersey. It was some joke about like, well, when Godzilla's fighting this other monster and he kills the other monster, like, how do they get rid of the giant monster? I think they take him to New Jersey. And completely dumb, but I was getting laughs. And I realized, in retrospect over the years, listening to that original tape, it's like, oh, no, they're clearly just laughing at me. But it is also, I thought it was cute that a 15-year-old kid was up doing it.
Did you have a moment where you figured out, like, while you were on stage, where you're like, oh, I'm good at this? Like, was there like a tip-off?
No, I don't even know if I guess you kind of think you're good at it. But I just remember going like, oh my God, I'm getting laughs and this feels great.
Sure. Yeah,
and I just kind of got off on that. And I remember afterwards, my parents took me and a friend that we brought to Shakey's Pizza and like saying like, oh, I have this future as a comedian and all that, and then that was sort of the first time is sort of this amazing, cathartic moment. And then you get into the nuts and bolts of like, I got to come up with a new act. Suddenly I thought every time I go up, I had to have a new act.
I love it. As you continued acting through, through school, I know that you were on all sorts of different shows. You did an episode of Facts of Life. Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
Correct.
That must have been an extraordinarily interesting set to be in. I know you did Gary Shandling's show as well. And some other. You got to work with some very interesting and fun people.
No, I was really lucky. I mean, I got to, the Facts of Life was the first like real acting Hollywood job I got. Because I was a stand-up. I'd been doing stand-up professionally. And so I had like a five-year period from 85 to 90 where, you know, it's so hard to become a regular on a show. You know, a million auditions and you have to go to the network and you're competing with these other people and you have to, you know, make the head of the network choose you. So when you finally get it, you're always like, oh, my God, my life has changed. You know, I remember I was the first show I was a regular on was Dirty Dancing, the TV series. And I remember, you know, we were shooting it. It was a single camera thing. And the day we were going to premiere, I remember I was at Arby's. I used to eat Arby's all the time in Van Nuys. I loved it. And I remember sitting in Arby's going like, well, this is the last time I'll ever be able to eat at Arby's because once the show goes out, I'm going to get mobbed and, you know, it's going to be terrible. They'll probably tear my clothes off and all that. And then slowly you start to realize, oh, yeah, you know, first of all, it's a miracle if a show takes off anyway. And then if you're the sixth or seventh lead, then no one knows who the hell you are. So, you know, I'd had that experience four separate times. Then on a show called Good Sports with Ryan O'Neal and Farrah Fawcett. Then the Louie Show with Louie Anderson. And then the Jackie Thomas Show that was Tom Arnold's show.
When you got cast on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, that was a big show. And I remember it being a big TV show at the time. And you had Melissa Joan Hart, and you had the puppeteered robot cat. There was a lot of things happening on
Nick
that
Bakay,
show.
Nick Bakay, voiced by the amazing Nick Bakay. Yes.
Absolutely. What was that experience like doing a show like that?
Sure. So by the time Sabrina rolled around, I was already kind of going like, I don't know if I can take sort of not having the control. Because, you know, you'd be on a show, you think your life has changed and the show gets canceled. Then you're just back on the street and, you know, you could save up some money for when it was on. But then you'd have a year when you wouldn't work and just waiting for the phone to ring. So finally, after four, you know, shows falling apart, I had a hit. And so it's like, oh, thank God. So then you take your foot off the brake. And so what I did was I took all the money I'd made. I'd saved up about $35,000 from doing the show. And I'd written this low-budget independent feature that I could make for cheap, about four people showing up in a field on one day, natural lighting, all this. But, you know, it was back before digital, so you had to buy the film. So I had to buy like 30 – all my money went to buying 60-millimeter film and processing it. And – so I shoot this thing going like, okay, I'm going to come back the next season and, you know, I'll restock the coffers, and basically bankrupted my family, you know, my wife and I. And then as I'm in post-production, I get a call from the show. They're like, hey, we got some bad news. We don't really know how to write for your character anymore. So we're going to cut it out, you know. But the good news is we might have you on for like one or two guest spots. It's like, this is not good news.
Oh, no. How do you not just completely, you know, lose your mind in terms of like, what do I do now? Obviously you had some money set aside, you wanted to make this film, but at the same time you're like, oh, I'm married, I have a wife, how do we sort of move forward? How do we continue?
I was like, I'm going to stake a claim. I'd rented an office and I was paying this office, you know, rent to go there and write. So it just kind of like, all right, I'm out of the nest. I'm going to spend all my full-time job was trying to get this movie into film festivals. And I mean, that's all I did all day long, was sending it out and contacting and, you know, all these places. And then that became my full-time job.
Yeah.
But we were running out of money. And I remember right like towards the end of that year going like, I guess this might be it. Like I mean, and I was going, okay, I'll get a job at a bookstore because I really like bookstores and I'll do that. And I remember the worst moment was, my wife was working hard and she wanted a vacation. She wanted to go to Vancouver. So we took this 1 week vacation to Vancouver. But the whole time we're on vacation, I'm like, I don't know how to pay for this. And she was paying for it, but she didn't have that much money.
That's the worst feeling.
Yeah. And you're just trying to enjoy let's yourself, have a vacation.
I
literally thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown on that
yeah,
vacation.
No, I get that. And you painted yourself into a corner in some ways because all the safety nets are gone.
Yeah.
And so you have this office and people know that you
are a strong writer and that you know that you're a good writer.
Yeah, but nobody really knew. I mean, isn't that nice that he wrote these scripts, you know, these episodes of the TV show, and they were like, yeah, these are good, but it didn't register other than, oh, he's an actor and he wrote something that he can be in.
So how do you decide that it's time to write Freaks and Geeks? Like, how do you make a jump like that?
What happened was I got into a film festival that was called Flicks Tour. So I submitted to that, and they picked three filmmakers, and the whole context of it was, okay, we're going to fly each of you into a different city in the Midwest. We're going to rent each of you cars. We're going to book you in all these different colleges. And so what will happen is every day you'll drive to a different college and show the movie and do a Q&A.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the next day you'll drive to the next place. You know, but these are all like really tiny colleges. Like,
sure.
I've never heard of in my life. You know, these were not prestigious colleges. But it was—
So you're just driving all over the country with these— with your film.
Driving around the country with my film and showing it, which was, you know, just to jump to a different thing. It was the greatest thing for a filmmaker to be held accountable at every single screening of your movie.
Wow.
Because then you're suddenly going like, oh my God, the things I thought were so important and the shots I thought I couldn't cut out of, you know, suddenly like you're going, cut, cut, cut. Oh my God, I don't need to see him walk all the way from the car to the middle of the field.
Yeah.
But right. But the genesis of Freaks and Geeks was, you know, I was going out on this tour, but I knew it didn't, you know, I was going to make a little bit of money, but at least it was something. So it kind of got my ego up of like, okay, the movie, somebody's going to see the movie. Somebody liked it. But I always had to be writing. I was always writing something. And so for years I'd been wanting to do something about high school because I'd seen, you know, every TV show and movie about high school. And it was always about like the dating lives of the cool kids. It always felt like to me.
And Beverly Hills, 90210. Yeah,
totally. And sure. They're all adults, you know, they're all in their 20s, clearly in their 20s. And they were just so cool with sex and all this stuff. And I was like, and I would watch these things. I was like, was I a freak? You know, because I was terrified of everything. I mean, I had two dates in high school. One was
two more than me.
Yeah, see, you know, mine were so disastrous, they can't be considered dates. And so I was just like, I got to do a show about the people I knew, like my nerdy friends, and we were friends with the Burnouts, and I should do some kind of show like that. And actually, at one point, had bought a new typewriter, this IBM Selectric that I loved, and just to use it, I started like, I would tell stories when I'd be out with friends like from high school and just humiliating stories, and they always got big laughs. So I was like, right. I'm going to write these stories down. So I started writing this book called School. And I remember I was like really into it and writing stories about dodgeball and all these things. And then I told my dad one day, I said like, hey, I'm writing a book. He says, a book? What about? I said, well, just my experiences in school. And he says, well, who cares about your experiences in school? And
hilarious.
It was such a buzzkill. And I was like, you're right. And I just put it away and didn't touch it.
I guess no one.
Wow.
Yeah, totally. And yeah. I put it away for a couple of years. But then, you know, when I was going to go out on the road, I knew I was going to be driving around for a few weeks. And I was like, I got to write something. And so just the math of like, Welcome to the Dollhouse and Felicity and going like, hey, maybe I could write that show. And I was sitting in my, I remember, I'll tell you everything. I was sitting on the toilet, literally going like, I should write that show. And I want to write about, so it would be like the Nerds and the Burnouts. And I was like, well, Freaks, we used to call them Freaks. That you know, was the name in Detroit. And I said, well, Nerds and Freaks. No, well, Geeks. Well, we never called ourselves Geeks, but it kind of rhymes. So, well, yeah, Freaks and Geeks. Maybe I do that. And so I was out at dinner with my wife the night before I went on the road. And I said, I'm thinking about maybe writing a high school show about my, you know, life and called, you know, Freaks and Geeks. And I remember she just put her hand up like for a high five. And she like gave me a high five. And she goes, that's what you should write. She goes, that sounds like something you should write.
That's cool.
God, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I went out on the road and I wrote it. I was out for 2 weeks and wrote it. Those 2 weeks I was out, it just poured out of me. And a lot of it was, you know, the whole dodgeball game was right out of the chapter that I had written in that book about dodgeball.
So Freaks and Geeks gets picked up.
Yeah.
Acclaimed by everybody, a well-loved show. And then after 18 episodes, if I'm correct, gets canceled.
Yeah, actually gets canceled after 12 episodes.
Oh, okay.
After 12 episodes air, but we made 18. No, it was really weird because, I mean, when the show got picked up, you know, I finished writing it and sent it to Judd, and he loved it, and he had this deal at DreamWorks, and so suddenly DreamWorks sold it to NBC, and suddenly I went from being a complete, you know, falling apart failure to like, oh my God, I've got a show I created on NBC.
Oh my God.
And we were in production, and then we got picked up, and we're, you know, doing this whole season. And it just like my whole life changed. Remember, I was on the tube in London, with my notebook, and I remember just writing, I think I'm about to finally get everything I wanted out of life.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so it's kind of like, yeah, and just going in and like, oh my God, I have a, you know, this show up and running and all that, you know, and it was coming out great and critically acclaimed, but the ratings were dropping, and they were dropping every week, and they were dropping huge. And on top of that, the network aired us for the first 2 weeks, and they pulled it off for 4 weeks to air the World Series.
Oh, shit.
And then they brought us back for, I think, another 4 weeks. Then they pull us off the air for 2 months because they want to move us off of Saturday night because they think maybe the night's the issue. But then they put us back on Monday nights, and they put us up against Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which is the biggest show on TV at the time.
Oh, my God.
Costs a fraction of what ours cost. So it's just going downhill, downhill, downhill. So you start to go like, oh, my God, I think I'm about to lose my show. Mm-hmm. But we just kept making it and kept making it. And then when we finished everything and we were posting the last six and number 12 aired, and then my mom died
like
2 days later. And so I'm just kind of rocked by that because it was completely unexpected. And
how old was she?
She was 74, you know, too young. Yeah, exactly. And then 2 days later, they canceled the show. So I was like literally in a meeting with my parents' lawyers trying to figure out all the, you know, everything, you know, their business.
God. Yeah.
And Judd calls me up just completely, you know, falling apart and saying, you know, it says like they canceled the show. And I was so exhausted from just making the show. And then my mom, there was just like, I think I had a moment of like, okay, like I was almost like, thank God I can't take anymore, mm-hmm. you know, but then it was like a few days after that, then it starts to slowly sink in. And then it becomes like the death of a bunch of people because you're going like,
right.
Oh my God, I like all these characters are real people to me now. These are my family. And now they're all dead because you're like, now there's nothing we can do with them. And I had all these stories I wanted to write for them.
Yeah, and you'd based this show on so many important parts of your life.
Yeah, and it's and a weird...
That's a weird
dynamic. It's a weird rejection almost because you're like, this is my life. Like, literally, the public has said, we don't care about your take on the world and your life and what you went through. I mean, I was lucky enough to, you know, the first professional directing job I got after directing the finale of Freaks and Geeks was two episodes of Arrested Development.
God, it's such a weird thing. I've talked to actors before about this feeling of, I think it's called astronaut syndrome, where mm-hmm. like you finally get to this heightened place that is bigger and it's more incredible than anything you've ever experienced in your life. And doing a show like Freaks and Geeks, it's your show, you've created it, you're in charge, it's your baby, and then suddenly you don't have it anymore, and then you have to go back down to being a TV director, which, by the way, is a huge deal, but not being able to be at that position anymore, it does feel like a big
charm. How do I find my way back to the moon, right?
Yeah.
It was a charmed
life. You weren't slumming.
Life. No, totally. But once you've tasted, like, the astronaut, mm-hmm. the moon, it's like everything feels like a come down, weirdly. Yeah. And I was, and again, I was working with wonderful people. And the fact that I was had been co-run a show that people, all the other writers and showrunners really liked. I even had, you know, I was a director who could actually go into the writer's room, who could have input, you know, and I got the respect of them. I wasn't just getting pushed around like sometimes a TV director can.
Yeah.
So I was living a charmed life that way, but I just felt miserable.
So you did I Am David and Unaccompanied Minor, which both didn't perform well at the box office.
Yeah.
And so where were you at that point?
Well, you know, when I did Uncomedy Minors, it was like, okay, I did something for the independent world. Let's see what a studio movie's like. Because I always hear, like, studio movies are nightmares, and a director, blah, blah, blah. I was like, you know what? I got nothing to lose. Let's go for it. So I did the studio movie, and I had a great time doing it, although I really hit a lot of rocks with it, of the studio head kind of turning on the script when we were a week into production and shutting us down and making us rewrite and all this stuff. You know, but we got through it, and I was, you know, I was as happy with the end product as I could be, despite all the meddling.
It was basically Home Alone, but with a bunch of kids, but in
an airport. Right. But it was based on a This American Life story, so it was actually supposed to kind of have this second layer about divorce and children divorce and what makes a family. And that was all in the first draft, and then we got a week into production, he suddenly decided, well, I don't know if I want all that stuff in here, because I'm a divorced father, and I think it makes divorced parents look bad.
Oh.
So cut all that stuff out and just have kids romping around in an airport in a post 9/11 world.
Oh, so, wow. Yes. Fun.
I knew we were dead when I had my say in the marketing, and I did this kind of sizzle reel, and I said, like, just have it with them running around, you know, all our little action bits. So they kind of use that as a template. They show this thing. I'm sitting in a theater with all these kids and moms, and it's unspooling, and it's just like kids running amok in an airport and like security guards chasing them, and then the kids do something and the security guards all fall and they hurt themselves, and all this mom behind, she goes like, oh my. And I'm just like, oh boy, well, we're dead. And the movie just bombed. It just bombed horrendously. And so then I got thrown into what is called movie jail, which is a very, very real place. When your movie loses somebody money, then you go in.
Yeah. So how does one get out of movie jail?
One generally doesn't. You have to just kind of power your way out of it. I was fortunate that I was directing, you know, on The Office and all these really well-regarded shows. So my name was popping up all over the place. So like people going, oh, I love that. Oh, your name was on that. So it was kind of helping me, but it's still like I was up for Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I loved book. And I was like, well, I got to be able to direct that. And, you know, I'm known for working with kids.
Sure.
And at the last minute, I was going to get it. And the last minute, the head of the studio was like, no, we don't want him. We want somebody else.
Well, because of movie jail.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, my God.
That was the beginning of rock bottom, realizing I'm not going to dig out to do movies again. Because, like, if I can't get a kid's movie, then I'm really in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, again, directing TV and enjoying it. But I remember I do the morning walk. I have this 4-mile walk I do every morning. And I remember I would just, my weird thing in my head, I'd go like, well, I guess I'm just running down the clock. And that became this thing in my head. You're just going to run down the clock. You're going to, you know, you'll direct TV and it's great. You'll be on great shows, but you're just not going to get to do your own stuff. So just kind of embrace it. You make the money that you make from directing TV, which is good.
Sure.
And just run down the clock and kind of think about what you'll do for vacations and all that. But it was not a happy place for me.
Sure.
And so in the middle of all this, I have a really good commercial agent, and I get offered this series of internet commercials for Macy's, and it's going to star all these people, Martha Stewart, Rachel Roy, Tommy Hilfiger, and Donald Trump.
Oh, nice.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And so I go off to New York, which I love, but I'm directing these internet commercials, and I'm just kind of going like, oh, is this it? Like, now it's not even The Office. You know, I mean, I'm doing other shows, but like there was just something so – I mean, everybody was very nice on it, and it was, you know, working with Martha Stewart was really interesting, and Tommy Hilfiger and all these people. But it was honestly, it was Trump that kind of bottomed me out because he wasn't mean to me at all. I mean, honestly, it was like all I was told, you know, is like, he's got to get out. He doesn't want to be. You got to understand with Trump, he doesn't want to be anywhere. So you got to get him in. You got to get him out. Got to get him in, get him out. And I'm already like a nervous enough director. I'm trying so hard to keep everybody happy.
Oh, no.
That's my only thing I care about, is like keeping the actors happy, keeping everybody happy. And so I'm like, okay, we're going to set this thing up. And I'm literally going to have it. Donald Trump's going to walk through the door. I'm going to have the cameras on him because it was kind of docu-style. And we're going to go like, and we're shooting. So he comes in with Melania, and I'm like, all right, Donald, we're all set to go. He's like, whoa, hold on. I can get my makeup on and stuff. So, all right. Okay. So he goes, you know, but I'm already going like, see, I'm on time. So just remember that. It's not me holding you up.
Yeah.
So he went, and, you know, 10 minutes later, he had his makeup on, and we go in, and this thing's in two parts. It's like a before and after. He's going to save a kid's bake sale and help this little kid who can't put it together.
Interesting. Some pretty good stuff, huh? Hey, what's your name?
Timmy.
That's good. That's a nice, firm handshake. Where's your team?
Huh?
In business, you need a team.
Oh, I have one.
Look at your competition. They're all making a lot of money, and you're sitting here. So we're going to make you a winner. Do you want to be a winner?
Yeah.
Let's go to Macy's. We're going to suit them up properly.
So he comes through, we do it, and we kind of shoot it in like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes, get through this whole thing. And I'm like, Donald, we got it. You know, and it's like, you know, he'd been there for 45 minutes since he walked in. He's like, oh, my God, that's great. Paul, you're the greatest. This guy, look at what he did. Oh, my God. Thank you. Anytime you need, you know, anything, let me know. And it's like, whoa, Donald, actually, I'm sorry. We still have a second half we got to do. We have to reset the room and everything. He's like, what? I goes, come on, man. I was supposed to be out of here an hour ago. And it's like, an hour ago? You got out of here 45 minutes ago. Like, I'm not the master of time and space. So then he's kind of like stewing. So I'm like, so I'm going into like, huh, huh. So I'm getting all like kind of nervous and kind of like, okay, guys, hurry up, hurry up, hurry. So we're running around, and then so you kind of get it all set up. We get through the next part, and I'm going in my head like, okay, I'll just shoot his stuff. I'll shoot him out, and then we'll get all the other stuff we need. And so we shoot him out, and again, he's like, okay, great. Well, thanks, and he takes off. And I just kind of have this weird bottom-out moment where I'm just like, I almost have a nervous breakdown, a mini nervous breakdown where I'm just kind of like, okay, well, we got that. All right, well, we're done. We're done. And the added guys are going like, well, no, you got to shoot all the other stuff. You know, and it's like, oh wait, what do we need? And I'm kind of like walking around in a haze, and they're like, no, you need this. Okay. And so they're kind of like walking me through this thing. And I don't know what it is. If it's just, he's got some weird negative energy about him that just sucks everything out of you, or it was just me or what, but I was just like a wreck. And so I remember just being back in the hotel, like, what am I doing? Like, weird breakdown. I don't know why. And in the middle of all that, I get a phone call from my agent and going like, hey, that wedding movie that Judd, you'd gone to the read-through for, because like 3 years earlier, I'd gone to a read-through of the very first version of what would become Bridesmaids. But I was busy at the time. And so, you know, Judd wanted me to kind of shepherd it for a while, but it wasn't for sure. And we didn't know if it was going to happen. So it kind of fell apart. And then I called him later. He's like, no, it's dead. It's dead. So the agents say like, oh, no, that wedding movie is back. And I'm like, well, wait, what? I thought it was dead. No, they said, but there was another director on it, but then he fell out. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, but don't tell Judd that I want the job or anything, because I don't want him, I don't want to be a charity case. Because even though I was kind of bottoming out, I didn't want like a charity job.
Yeah.
For some weird reason, I needed it terribly. So I said, just put my name on a list with all your other directors and give it to him and see what happens. And like a half hour later, I get a call from him going like, all right, Ofig, we're going to do this movie. You know, it's the one that, you know, you were the reading for, but you got to get in there. You know, I want you to meet with Wig and make sure that she's cool with it. And then we're going to do all these rewrites and all that. And it was suddenly like, oh my God, like, am I getting out of movie jail? Possibly. Somebody opened the door to movie jail. And so I, you know, went on and did it.
Oh my God.
Wow, that's crazy.
The most amazing story.
It was wild. It was really wild.
God.
And you can thank Donald Trump for all of that.
I know, exactly.
When we come back, a lot more with Paul Feig.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The budget for Bridesmaids was $32.5 million.
After tax breaks.
After tax breaks, right? And it was shot, where was it shot?
L.A.
And here in L.A., okay. Right?
Yeah.
And it made $288 million
worldwide,
mm-hmm. Which is an extraordinary break out of movie jail. There's never been a break out of movie jail like that.
It was
pretty great.
And I just wanted to ask a quick question. When you're directing Bridesmaids, you know, still feeling like you're in movie jail, is there a lot of pressure on yourself to, yeah, as you're directing this film?
Oh yeah. I felt so much pressure on that. You know, and you try to separate it out, because when you're in the moment, it's just about like making the best thing and having fun and coming up with jokes and figuring it out. So in the moment, it was always fun, but it was like at night, you know, trying to sleep, and you're just like, it's not going to do it. You know, like, I hope we didn't fuck that up. And then as it's going well, then you're like, okay, today's the day I'm going to fuck it up. You're always like, but that's like, every time you direct a movie, that's that feeling of like, today's the day I'm going to screw everything up.
Right.
You know, and, but it's what drives you weirdly. It's that fear. But yeah, it's in there. And the thing though, when we were making it, it was terrifying, because I always refer to it as strike three. I kept saying, mm-hmm, I'm making strike three, right? This is going to either go one or two ways. And we knew we were doing something really good, because the talent involved was so good.
Right.
But when we were about to come out, we were tracking really poorly, and the ad campaign was just okay because they kind of, the commercials, they couldn't figure out if they're going to sell it like a comedy or like a romantic comedy. And so they leaned in a little more. You know, every ad had Melissa burping and saying, I don't know which end that came out of, which on its own, you know, we were selling all these mean articles were getting written about like Paul Feig made a movie where he's just making fun of, you know, plus size women. And I was like, no, that's not, you haven't seen the movie. What are you talking about? You know, don't judge it on that one thing. Yeah. And then we were told, you know, that opening weekend, we had to make $20 million. If we didn't make $20 million, the movie would be considered a failure because sure, it wouldn't make wow. enough money.
Of course.
And so we were tracking to make $13 million. And I got a call Friday morning from my agent after they did midnight screenings that just did okay because it's a wedding movie. Nobody knows. So they're like, well, the movie just did okay last night. And so that led there for predictions to be like 13. It says, I'm sorry, it's going to be 13. And you're just like, oh my God. So I remember, again, I always get all bad news when I'm sitting on the toilet. I remember like I was sitting on the toilet when I got that call, and I'm just sitting there like not being able to get off the toilet and going like, oh my God, fuck, you know, like strike three comes true. And on top of it, I knew all these female writers who were inspired by the fact that we had this female cast, and they were out pitching ideas around the town, and the town was saying to them, we got to wait and see how Bridesmaids does.
Oh wow.
Jesus. So then you're like, well, what the fuck? So if I single-handedly will kill movies for women for the rest of eternity. So just like completely bottoming out that day. But then throughout the day, like at a call, like the agent, like, well, okay, it's looking more like $15 million. It's like, okay. And then like late afternoon, it's like, well, I mean, the matinees did okay. It looked like $17 million. So I was like, well, this is kind of going up. Mm-hmm. So I called Melissa and said, you know, Melissa and Ben, who live in my neighborhood, said like, come on over for dinner and let's just, you know, commiserate or just be together. And it was, we're at dinner. They're calling like, you know, it's actually looking like 19. Then I got the call like, it's looking like 20. And then like a few minutes later, like actually they're predicting 22. Then it was going to be 24, and we're just like, holy shit. And so it's like, get in the car, everybody. So we all jump in the car, and we drive to the Arclight and go, and it's walk into this theater, and it's packed, and the place is rocking.
So amazing.
Yeah, and then it was just like, that was the greatest, because you're like, oh, thank God. I didn't ruin movies for women, and I think I've avoided strike three.
Right. I'm out of movie jail forever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, now I've made a lot of movies, and they've, you know, a bunch of them have done really well, which is great. And you always go like, oh, well, I guess the fear is going to go away now. Now at least I'll lose that fear of failure or just of like everything's going to fall apart and just go, okay, now I can kind of settle in. And it never goes away and it just gets worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And you're so driven by the fear and you're always just like, oh, no, this one's going to, you know, be the one that takes me down.
Right.
Which is why Ghostbusters was such a weird experience for me. I jump on Twitter and write my infamous tweet of like, I'm going to reboot Ghostbusters with an all-female cast. That's who I'm going to call. And I hit send and like, who wouldn't be excited about this? Because I'd had nothing but a great relationship with the internet because of Freaks and Geeks and all my other movies. And, you know, it's been nothing positive. So I just go like, oh, this would be fun. What a fun time. I'm going to get all these fun tweets back. And the tweets start coming in and they're really fun. And everybody's like, yeah, I was excited. And these women are excited and guys are excited and Ghostbusters fans are excited. And I go to bed that night like, this is the greatest thing. And then I wake up the next morning and check my Twitter feed. And it's like, oh, my God. The story had gone wider and gone through all the geek sites and through Reddit and 4chan and all those places. And all of a sudden, my feed turned into the ugliest place I'd ever seen in my life threw me back into getting bullied in the locker room.
Sure, yeah, I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
I mean, suddenly it's like every bully that I'd ever escaped was in my phone, was
and
screaming at me.
And there's thousands of them.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And they don't stop.
And they're telling, they're hoping that I die. They're hoping that Katie Dipple dies. I mean, they're literally wishing death upon us, you know, and you're just like, I'm back in high school. And it just dogged me for 2 years.
Oh my God.
How did you deal with that?
Well, at first you try to convince yourself you're amused by it because there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're moving forward and the thing's happening. So I kind of tried to make it funny to myself, but it's still like, you know, I was addicted to Twitter and just like, oh my God, I'm just getting punched in the face constantly. You know, and occasionally there'd be nice things in there. So you're like, oh, I'll look for the next nice one. And like, oh, and you punch. More ugly stuff. So the first year we're going all through production and I'm not engaging with them at all. I'm not saying anything, and I'm posting pictures because I know every time we're shooting outside, somebody's going to take a cell phone picture. So I'm like managing where, you know, let's sneak out the proton pack. Let's sneak out the uniforms. And so it was really fun. There was this whole cat and mouse with the internet. And so that got me through it because it was fun. And we had tons of fun making the movie, you know, and all that. So I go on vacation, and when we wrap and while my editor's putting together the first assembly, and we go to Italy to my, you know, I love Capri is my favorite place in the world. So we go to my favorite restaurant, which is up on a sea cliff and overlooking the Mediterranean. It's gorgeous. And so I have some wine, and my wife goes to the bathroom, and I'm like, let me just look on Twitter. And I look on Twitter, and there's these two guys that were just dogging me, like, I mean, from day one, and just saying the most horrendous shit about my cast, about me, and about Katie and everybody. And just in that wine fueled moment, I was like, you know what? Fuck this guy. You know, like, I'm going to fire back at this asshole. And I fire back at him. You know, and he only has 96 followers.
Oh,
so
fuck
right
that
there.
Guy.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And I hit him with something, and then the other guy writes me back, and I, fuck you, and I do this whole thing against them. And I'm like, you know, so my wife comes back in the bathroom, and I'm sitting there like the cat that ate the canary, and she's like, what? I said, like, I feel so good. I just fucking took down these two guys who've been up my ass for a year. And she goes, like, should you have done that? I said, yes, of course. I feel great. And then, like, I go back to the hotel, and then I get, like, an email from Judd, like, you really shouldn't have done that. Like, you know, you should just ignore these guys. I said, I've been ignoring these guys for a year, you know, and he's like, well, just block them. I said, I don't want to block them because I'm Democratic and I want to make sure that I hear from everybody, everyone's voice. I hear everyone's opinion. I'm going to take it all in. And then I realized the next day, oh, fuck, I should not have done that. Because the minute you fire back at one troll, are the enemy. And suddenly I was the asshole. How dare you? So then, you know, it was kind of game over and we were open game. You know, so look, and the movie came out and it, you know, it just did okay. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. But I am very proud of it. And the denouement of that story was, you know, a year later, we got nominated for Best Feature Film at the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, and we ended up winning and beating Rogue One and Captain America.
Oh, my God.
Nice. And so, you know, for all that I've been told for, you know, 3 years, thanks for ruining my childhood, right. It was like, well, guess what? Actually, I think maybe we kind of helped other childhoods of actual children.
Absolutely.
So it was a nice thing. So, it did finally kind of come around.
I've noticed on your Twitter feed that there are a lot of fans out there who are sending you, like, Ghostbusters inspired art and other things like that. So that's got to be a bit of a feeling of redemption that, hey, you know, there are people out there who do like this movie, who do care about it, who are inspired by it.
Well, the best thing about it has been being contacted by so many girls and young women and women in general who say, you know, look, the movie's about pseudoscience, but they were still scientists and they were doing science, you know, based things. So many women reaching out saying, like, if I had this movie when I was a kid, I would have been a scientist by now. I would have been an engineer by now.
Wow.
You know, and girls being inspired to go into science and to learn about it. And that's where you go, that's the power that we can have with this. And that's where, you know, for whatever the trolls who don't want women in their movies, you know, or minorities in their movies or anything like that. You go, like, it's representation that matters, and you have to show this on the screen. You know, the world is a changing place. The demographics of this world are changing. I mean, there's always been – women have always been more than half the population of the world, and yet for some reason they're not allowed to have their own – you know, either have their own movies or to be in the movies that normally had guys in it. Like,
well, you're such an advocate for women. You keep putting people in their best possible – glow. You know, that's what it feels like.
Well, I appreciate that. I always, when, like, you know, sometimes people in my things will be very thankful. And it's like, this is not so selfless. I wouldn't have hired you if I didn't think you were awesome. Right. You know, I mean, like Kate McKinnon, you know, holy shit. You know, just the fact that she, you know, look, she already had her big showcase being on SNL, but her being in Ghostbusters, you know, just made so many more people aware of her, and now she's the superstar. And Leslie Jones is blown up, gigantic
huge stuff for Leslie Jones.
Yeah, and it is just finding the best people, and then they shine.
I really wanted to ask you about this. Your motivation as a creator and as a writer, I don't know if this is how it was for you, but after your mother passed away, did your motivation change as far as like why you were trying to be who you are? Because without her around, like, does that kind of change your dynamic of what you know what you're trying to do?
I think so. I mean, it was definitely part of it, but I've always been very, very driven. I've always been crazy ambitious, and I've always been very competitive too. Not sports-wise, but just like if I see somebody else has done something, had a success, it's like, oh my God, I need to do something similar, or I need to have that level of success, which is a petty thing to have, but also I think you almost can't make it in the business if you don't have some element of that. You just have to be you have to be driven, you know, and however that manifests itself, whether it's through being competitive, whether it's just being ambitious, whatever it is, you have to be pushing forward. And so definitely my mom, you know, I wanted to, because she was such a believer in me and pushed me to do so much stuff in a good way, you know, it's just supportive in that way, that it definitely felt like a responsibility to try to make it. But it was also this weird thing of like, oh, am I going to make it? And she's not going to know.
Right.
And my father just had no idea. He didn't understand the business at all. I mean, when I made I Am David, and, you know, I was away in Bulgaria for 6 months, and I finally came back, and we did cut a teaser trailer for it, and my wife went and showed it to him, and he's like, I mean, he was away for 6 months for that? It's not even a movie. It's only like 2 minutes long. It's like, okay, do you really not fucking understand the idea of a trailer?
Oh my God. Really?
So yeah. So it's like, where's mom? Where's mom, the person who understands this?
It's a 2 minute movie.
Yeah, exactly. Oh what God. A production it was. Oh. Well, if I can just end with the words of my father, who told me his favorite thing was Winston Churchill made a speech once. I don't even know if this is true or not, but my dad said it was true, where he just got up in front of some graduating class and he said, his speech was, never, 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 never give up. And he walked off stage.
Really?
And whether it's true or not, that's always been my mantra of like, you know what? Don't give up, man, because you don't know what's going to happen next. And right when you think you're in the toilet, then an idea comes or the phone rings or something hits you or somebody shows up and it's like, you know what? Tomorrow's another day. You know, I look at life sort of like an Etch-a-Sketch where you do all this stuff and you go like, well, that drawing's weird. And then you just pick it up and shake it over your head and put it back down and it's all clear again. And I always feel like a good night's sleep is like shaking an Etch-a-Sketch. And you're like, all right, the next morning I'm going to wake up with more energy than I had when I went to bed. And I can probably solve something. And if I can't, I'll go to bed again the next night and I'll eventually figure it out.
Right.
I love it. Well, thanks again for having us, buddy. This was amazing.
Yes, thank you, Paul. You. We're very honored
having
you.
Jack, Steven, you guys are the greatest. Thank you so much.
Never Surrender is produced by Western Sound. Executive producers are Jack Hergoth, Stephen Kramer Glickman, and Ben Adair. Producers are Sabrina Fang and Cameron Kell. Music by Hannes Brown.
On social media, you can check us out on Instagram at Never Surrender Pod, on Twitter at Surrender Pod, and on Facebook at Never Surrender Podcast. You can also email us at neversurrenderpodcast@gmail.com to share your own stories about how you struggled, failed, and ultimately never surrendered.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.